documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
We're just south of the Great Lakes capital city, suffering through the burnout of another election year, and broadcasting live from FEMA Region 5, where the spring has sprung in the swamplands of reinvented Michigan. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours. Vicki Davis is joining us as well. It's nice to have you with us once again on this 12th of March, 2016. It's good to have you with us, folks. As I said, spring has sprung. It's turned out to be absolutely beautiful here in southern Michigan. Probably the mildest March that I think we've ever had, at least in recent memory, anyway. And I'm under no illusions that the cold weather could very well return before it stays. The warm weather stays. Anyway, there's a lot going on today. I don't want to delay any at all. I want to bring Vicki Davis up online. By the way, I did notice that we had some noise on the line today, so hopefully you folks won't lose the stream. You know, if there's noise on the voice line, obviously there's going to be noise on the data line as well. So we're going to try to do our best here to avoid losing the satellite connection. Sometimes, though, if data problems exist, what happens with the automation over American Voice Radio Network is it'll just go, if it loses the feed, it'll just go to the next item on its automation to avoid having dead air over there. So hopefully that doesn't happen today. I did notice, like I say, though, some noise once in a while here, especially living in the rural areas where we're operating from. We sometimes have the weather change. Weather changes seem to be really, they really adversely affect the data on these, you know, DSL streams. And so, anyway, since we've had the weather change, lots of moisture in the air and humidity and stuff like that. I don't know, there may be some moisture in the line somewhere, and so I may have to get a tech out here to deal with it. Anyway, we'll do the best we can, though. Vicki. Hopefully she's still there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, hopefully I don't lose you, but you sound good so far.
Okay, well, that's good. I hope my voice will keep up with the program. I've had, I think, bronchitis.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah.
Well, you may be whispering to us before long.
Yeah, possibly.
Well, that's okay. If you need to duck out or something, That's all right, too. Well, I'm glad you're here, though. These are certainly eventful times. And the Malheur National Wildlife thing certainly continues to play itself out. I know Ammon Bundy has done some interviews with... I'm surprised he would even be willing to talk to the Oregonian, given the fact that these characters have basically crucified all of those people out there, and the propaganda and BS that this rag publication puts out. But he did, and he's talking to a number of news outlets from jail, some of whom have recorded what he said. And I don't know, it's very hard, you know. I mean, being in jail is not easy anyway.
No, probably the Oregonians are the only ones who can get the interviews, so, you know, he may not have a choice.
Well, I did see one of the local television affiliates also interviewed him, and of course, his, you know, Ammon's legal counsel was there the whole time and prompting him on certain things that he shouldn't be saying, questions that, you know, as soon as they asked the question, he'd say no. The lady that was there said no, and so they're very, you know, protective, of course, given the fact that this is a pending situation where the trial's coming up and everything. And I saw also that they have increased new charges. They've added more charges to Ammon.
Well, they're doing the same thing with Ammon Bundy and all the rest of them that were arrested, that they did with Dwight Hammond and his son, you know, they just add on, pile on charges, and it doesn't matter whether they're true or not. They don't really care about that. I mean, the U.S. Attorney's Office has no integrity whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, they've most of those charges, if not all of them, are made up. The only thing they really did that was accurate was to go stay at an abandoned, what is basically an abandoned federal facility.
Yeah. Well, the Associated Press says the new charges come as the government cracks down on the Bundy family. Okay, so I guess a lot of this stuff has to do with the standoff, apparently.
Yeah, and it wasn't really a standoff. I mean, the first time I went down there, there was a fishing wildlife guy down there.
Yeah, at the Bundy Ranch.
At the Bundy Ranch. Yeah,
I think they're going back to that. And they seem to be rounding people up. We speculated on this show about back a while ago that may be what's happening, that they're starting to round people up pertaining to that Bundy Ranch incident.
Oh, yeah, very definitely. I went to a rally yesterday just about a week and a half ago, and it was on charges stemming from the Bundy Ranch episode. So they are definitely doing that.
Yeah. Well, and how long is it going to be? See, the problem is that I don't know. It's amazing to me what little the feds are willing to use to arrest somebody anymore. It's astounding to me that, you know, just being there, you know, and I've went back and forth. You know, I've said before, I don't entirely trust Pete Santilli, for instance. But I'm hard-pressed to really know anything that Pete Santilli did there to warrant being arrested. Seems to me like all he was trying to do is negotiate. Unless there's something I didn't see, he was trying to just negotiate getting the women and children out of that refuge before the FBI came and stormed the place. And they grabbed him and arrested him.
Right.
Now, he did, I'm sure, make some incendiary or angry remarks on his stream. I don't know that he ever did anything threatening. In fact, all they arrested him, as far as I know, is interfering with, you know, the standard 5-year term of interfering with a federal agent's ability to do their job or something like that.
And yeah, and he didn't interfere at all. I mean, he never prevented them from doing anything. And as far as I know, he didn't even carry a weapon.
Yeah.
So how was he interfering? I see, that's what I mean. They have no integrity. They just make things up.
Yeah. Well, Frank DuBois, who was the former New Mexico Secretary of Agriculture back from 1988 to 2003, he also served as a assistant to a U.S. Senator, a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Interior. He made a comment about these new charges against Ammon Bundy, and he says, prevent bail, up the charges, and extend the trial date. He says, all of this is designed to put pressure on the defendant to reach a plea deal.
Right.
Typical Fed moves. You know, and that indicates to me, you know, whenever they try to pressure somebody into a plea deal, it indicates that they have a weak case.
Yeah. I, if I were Ammon, I would not take the plea deal. I would want a trial by jury trial.
Well, the problem with that, of course, and I agree with you on that, hopefully he would be able to get a jury that is unbiased enough in that area where he's going to be tried.
Well, the attorney can always ask for a change of venue, and they should.
Yeah. And from every indication, it does seem like he does have a good attorney.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The reason I would think that he would want a jury trial was because they did this occupation of Malheur to bring attention to what the BLM is doing. If he accepted a plea deal, then basically all of his effort in doing that would be for naught. So it's only really in a jury trial, in a trial, where all of this could be brought to light.
Yeah.
And it needs to be brought to light. I mean, I have a couple of videos where in a congressional hearing, they're talking about the BLM putting ranchers out of business intentionally. And so,
That's
you know, there's evidence on the congressional record that they have done that.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this Oregon prosecutor who is calling the whole thing with Ammon Bundy and the others, or the shooting of Lavoie, I should say. Excuse me. He's calling that whole thing justified. We had that whole thing unfold this past week.
Yeah, that is so disgusting. I mean, it's so clearly an ambush. And I think I read that there were 5 federal agents, or at least 2 of them, lied about shooting into the vehicle.
Yeah. And well, what's interesting about that whole incident, and I'm sure you probably saw the video that was released this past week.
Yeah, I did.
I do have some audio clips from that. That whole video confirmed everything that the eyewitnesses inside the video were claiming. Victoria Sharp and Shauna Cox came out very publicly, and especially Victoria, she did a lot more interviews than Shauna was able to. But be that as it may, everything that they said was absolutely 100% true. And it was even worse, really. I mean, seeing that in there, the only thing that came through my mind, Vicky, was this is domestic terrorism. I mean, this is domestic. This is state-sponsored terrorism. I mean, there's no other terminology that you can use for it.
Right. And that's exactly why people went to the Bundy Ranch to begin with, because the federal agents, they tased a pregnant woman, they knocked another woman down, and they threatened to shoot everybody there, and that included women and children.
Yeah.
And since they had a history of doing that with Waco and Ruby Ridge, that's why people from all around the West ended up on the Bundy Ranch, was to prevent these federal gangsters from
thuggery.
Doing it again.
They're thugs. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
they are.
Going to the video, and for those of you folks who have not seen this, I will put this in the show notes, because this is something that really absolutely has to be seen to be believed. Most people have this naive thought about law enforcement, and bear in mind, I'm not saying that they're not good cops. There may even be some good, well-meaning FBI agents out there. The problem is, you're a part of a beast system that is largely victimizing the American people. We need cops of all stripes to be able to fight genuine crime. And there are cross-border crimes that, you know, take place all the time that, you know, need to be tracked down and fought. I mean, identity theft is a good example of that. You know, my daughter recently had a case of that where her identity was stolen. And I mean, this person that's done this has wreaked havoc on her life, you know. So these types of situations do come up, and we need real law enforcement, real people who are fighting crime. The problem is the FBI increasingly, it seems to me like their job more and more is just terrorism. You know, they orchestrate terrorism. They set it up in order to take it down to justify budgets. How do you justify doing that? There's no honor in entrapment. There's no honor in doing that kind of thing. And there certainly isn't any honor in ambushing people who are not a threat to society by any stretch of the imagination. You know, and again, we come back to these people could have been picked up any time, any place. They were going to community meetings.
Yes.
They were going to various places. At any time, they could have just tapped Ammon and anybody else here on the shoulder and said, hey, you're under arrest.
You know why I think they wanted to murder Lavoie? Because he was a historian, basically. You know, a self-taught historian. And so he knew a lot of the history. And he was very articulate.
Yes, he was.
When he explained things, it was crystal clear. And I really think that's why they wanted to take him out. Because he was the most articulate spokesperson for what they were doing and why they were doing it.
Yeah. Well, and if there's one thing I would have them change about this whole thing, about the standoff and everything, every single press conference they had, they should have mentioned the Hammonds. I mean, that should have been the front and center of every single thing they did. You know, but I can't really pick them apart. I mean, they did the best they could, but I mean, that's the main thing. It should have been hammered every single time. The Hammonds, the Hammonds, the Hammonds, the Hammonds, the Hammonds. Because that's really what this is really all about. That and, you know.
The feeling is that they, from people who knew what was going on there and was watching the whole thing, was that they were getting bad advice from the inside. Like that there were infiltrators and they were, emphasis on traitors, but that they were getting bad advice.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, you know, that they trusted some wrong people.
Yeah. Well, we got, like I said, the video, just chilling. Lavoie was yelling at the cops as the thing began. Now, I think people have to bear in mind that when the video starts, according to Victoria Sharp and Shauna Cox, as we said, both ladies independently stated that the cops had already shot at the car. Ryan Payne, who I understand was riding in the front on the passenger side, he had stuck his head out the window and then had to duck back inside after being shot at. And this was before that video ever even started. So even though he narrowly was shot, he still ended up getting out to talk to the police, and then that's when he was arrested. So all of this happened before the video ever started. The rest of them remained in the car. Now, you have to understand that context, I think, to appreciate why Lavoie is yelling at the cops to go ahead and shoot me when the video starts. Anyway, this is Lavoie.
Shoot me? You shoot me. I'm going to meet the sheriff. The sheriff is waiting for us. So you do as you damn well please. But I'm not going anywhere. Here I am, right there. Right there, put a bullet through it. You understand? I'm going to go meet the sheriff. You back down or you kill me now. Go ahead, put the bullet through me. I don't care.
Where's Ryan?
I'm going to go meet the sheriff. You do as you damn well please.
What for?
Well, I'm going to ask them if they want to go out.
What for? Why are we getting
out? You want
out?
Now, the cops at this point had said, get the women out of the car. And that's where Victoria says, what for? I think there was a very, very great likelihood that if they had done that, they would have opened fire and killed the remaining men inside the vehicle, Vicki.
I think you're probably right.
I think the fact that the women wouldn't get out basically saved everybody's life other than Lavoie, of course, who did get out.
Yeah. You know, the roadblock that they set up like that, that's considered deadly force. I heard some things about that basically being illegal in Oregon, the way that they did that.
Yeah, in fact, we've got some audio from a press conference from the from Lavoie's wife, his widow, who she made reference to that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, continuing with this a little bit.
What are we getting at?
Who are you?
Yeah, who are you?
Who are you? Who are you?
Oregon State Police.
Okay, well, I'm going over to meet the sheriff in Grant County. You come along with us, and you talk with us over there. You can go ahead and shoot me. Put the laser right there, put the bullet through the head. Okay, boys, this is going to get real. You want my blood on your hands? Get it done, because we got people to see and places to go.
One thing you got to give it to Lavoie, this man is absolutely fearless. I mean...
Yeah, foolishly so.
Well, I think he had gotten to the point where he didn't care anymore. I mean, he said he didn't care anymore. I mean, once you've been molested... And you got to keep in mind, they were targeting his ranch, too. I mean, he's had his run-ins with the BLM. And I think he's just got to the point where he's tired of it. And so, at some point, you know, you back a man into the corner long enough and poke him long enough, and, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than somebody that's got nothing to lose.
That's true.
You know? So, yeah. Anyway, they had, having already been shot at, and I think that's very important to stress that, they made the decision to keep driving, unaware that you know, there was a roadblock ahead that they were preparing to drive into. And now, this next clip, we pick it up where they approach the roadblock. You're going to hear the women talking about calling for help. At this time that they're running from the cops behind them, not knowing they're going to drive into, you know, a roadblock, but there's no cell service. You know, they approach the roadblock, and now you're going to hear the shots being fired as they approach the roadblock. This is very important because people need to understand. There, you know, there's this debate, Vicky, about, oh, well, was Lavoie reaching for a gun or not? Look, he was already under fire. It doesn't matter if he was reaching for a gun or not.
Yeah.
He's already under fire.
And besides, you know, as you watch him, I don't think he was reaching because he was hit.
Yeah.
In the autopsy report, he was shot three times in the back.
In the back. That's right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but this debate about, you know, oh, well, was he reaching for a gun? Was he not reaching for a gun? I mean, the point is that when you're under fire, some might be able to make the justification that it was self-defense because he's already being shot at. I mean, how can you say that a man doesn't have the right to defend himself? That's my question.
And besides, he was having cops yell at him from different directions. I mean, who do you listen to? You know, if they're yelling at you from different directions, you know.
Okay, here's the thing. He swerves in an attempt to go around the roadblock. Okay, now there was a press conference where they said he was using his car as a deadly weapon. Okay, and that was why they opened fire against. Give me a break. He was trying to drive around the roadblock. You know, and then he hit the snowbank and he stopped. Okay, he immediately jumps out with his hands up. Okay, that's very clear in both videos. He jumps out immediately, has his hands in the air, and as soon as he opens that door and jumps out, you hear gunshots. Okay, now the first initial ones miss, but you can hear that. Listen to this clip. Again, we pick it up with him going down the road, hits the snowbank, and as soon as you hear that door open, then you hear the firing.
No, mobile network not available.
Do you have numbers for people here in town?
Yeah. Hey,
okay, did you hear that? That was a gunshot as they approached the roadblock. That was the first. So before they ever even crashed the snowbank, they're already being fired upon. Okay, then they hit the snowbank.
Okay, they're shooting.
Hang on.
Okay, we're here.
Go ahead and shoot me.
Okay, I'm shooting.
Okay,
we're
shooting.
Stay down. Are they shooting him? Did I shoot him? You asshole.
Oh my god!
Okay. Stay down.
I can't get out.
Don't get out.
I'm an EMT! I need help! I'm an EMT!
Stop it.
Are you hit?
No, I'm an EMT! I need help!
No, hold on. Don't shoot. Hey, they're shooting. Don't do anything. The door is hit. Where the hell is LaVoy? Down.
I can't see.
Shut up. Stay down, Ryan.
Oh, God!
Stay down. Stay down. Hey! Did they kill him? I think they did, and they're shooting over here on this door.
Oh, I got hit, too.
Okay, hold still.
Where did you get hit? I don't know. It didn't.
Ryan? Hold still.
Ryan,
bleeding.
Where did you get
hit? Still.
I'm not bleeding.
Okay, don't shoot
where
us.
Where did you get hit, Ryan?
I'm okay.
I'm going to take some.
It's okay.
I'm taking some. Keep down. Oh. Well, I don't know. Get out of the car. How are we supposed to get out of the car?
Did they tell us to get out of the car?
No, I can't hear anything. I don't dare get out of the car. Oh, quit shooting the windows.
Where are they shooting at?
They're hitting the windows. I don't know. They're trying to break their window.
God, keep us safe, please.
Please protect us,
please, God.
Please protect us. Please protect us. We need help. We need help.
Did they kill him? They killed him.
I can see a laser coming in.
Okay, folks, we got the break coming up. We'll finish this up on the other side of the break. Stay with us. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America.
Drive on, cowboys, heading home.
Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Vicki Davis is here as well. And we're playing audio from the video that was released this past week of the ambush and the act of domestic terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism, as I call it, upon the people there as they were... You know, LaVoy and all the other folks that were on their way to meet with a sheriff at Grant County and the other members of the community to educate them. If they had wanted to, actually, the Oregon State Police had wanted to arrest them, they could have met them at the meeting. There was an infinite number of opportunities, infinite number of possibilities for them to make their arrests if that's what they chose to do. But instead, they chose to do an act of terrorism upon the people. And I believe that the reason for this is because they wanted to make an example out of somebody. What do you think, Vicki?
I absolutely think that's true. I think it was probably a warning to all of the other patriots that were at the Bundy Ranch,
yeah,
and that were supporting the people at Malheur. Because I think what the feds were looking at and what they are looking at is a growing movement of resistance.
Yeah.
And it's resistance for legitimate cause. The BLM really has become a criminal organization, and it became a criminal organization. I've been studying the President's Council of Sustainability. I found
you're cutting
1993, mm-hmm. And that's really when it started. That's when the reinvention of government started, and Bruce Babbitt was the Secretary of the Interior. And it was the Secretary of the Interior Department that hosted the President's Council on Sustainable Development.
Yeah, and we've got. I do have the audio from that. If you want to comment on that a little bit, Let's finish up with this clip real quick. I think there's about another minute left. And I wanted to play this because those people that might not listen, I want you to hear just what they are calling justified, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh my God, they killed him.
Okay. So where's the rest of everyone?
Are you okay?
Oh, yeah.
I can see lasers going by.
Where did you get hit?
I'm okay.
He's got lasers.
Got a laser.
Keep your head down. I can see the laser. If you see a laser, keep it away.
Dude,
there's laser on your knee. Stop! I don't dare get out because they'll shoot me.
I don't like hunkering down here either.
Me either, but I don't know what to do because they keep shooting lasers at us.
Get two stinking lax. Think things are just all dandy and fine. We got two damn lax.
Yeah. Damn, why do they keep shooting?
So that's how it went for a few more minutes, and then eventually they ended up getting out. Now, the cops at the press conference admit. What's interesting is they admitted that they were shooting at the truck before Lavoie ever got out.
As Mr. Finnicum rounded the curve in the road, he would have been able to see the roadblock, which was approximately 862 feet away, about the length of three football fields. Mr. Finnicum continued driving over 70 miles per hour as he approached the roadblock. An Oregon State Police Special Weapons and Tactics van was following Mr. Finnicum's truck at the same speed and was able to stop prior to the roadblock.
I don't believe for a second he was driving 70 miles an hour, because you don't drive that fast on those roads in the wintertime. I drove several times to Burns, Oregon, and those hilly areas that you drive through, they're pretty damn scary. You don't drive through those 70 miles an hour.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't be the first incident where they lied. The main thing that I wanted to focus on is the admission that they were already firing upon the truck
prior to the roadblock. Mr. Finnicum continued to travel at speeds in excess of 50 miles per hour. As an Oregon State Police trooper who was standing at the roadblock, fired three shots into the truck in an attempt to stop it.
Okay, so
did I miss something? The first guy said 70, didn't he? Or did I not hear that right?
I never heard him say that. Was it in this clip?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. Let me see.
As Mr. Finnicum rounded the curve in the road, he would have been able to see the roadblock, which was approximately 862 feet away, about the length of three football fields. Mr. Finnicum continued driving over 70 miles per hour as he approached the...
So what did the other guy say?
50. So one of them said 70. The other one said 50.
Mm. See, I didn't catch
50
that.
50 is more right. 50 is more accurate.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, obviously didn't get their story straight before they decided to tell whatever version of events took place. The thing that I took away from it, of course, though, is that, I mean, they're shooting at the car. Complete reckless disregard for any life that's in the truck. You know, if their beef was with Lavoie, I mean, they're putting everybody else at risk, too. You know, and anyway... I just found that to be quite a remarkable admission. Now, they go on to justify their assassination of Lavoie, you know, the man who they admit they shot at repeatedly, even though he hadn't fired one shot or pulled a gun on anyone.
Under Oregon law, Mr. Finnicum was using his truck as a dangerous weapon. A dangerous weapon is defined...
Now, that's important, because the difference between 50 and 70... is the difference of whether you're using your vehicle as a dangerous weapon, I think.
Well,
I would argue that as an attorney.
Well, I would argue also that how could any of these people feel threatened by his truck when they got the road blocked in such a way that the cars are angled, there's one in the center. I mean, all they have to do is just get out of the way. There's no place he can go. I mean, if he goes straight forward, he's going to crash into the cars. That's going to shield the officers. So how is there any threat, really, to any life? It's bullcrap is what it is.
Totally.
Anyway, he goes on.
Any weapon, device, instrument, material, or substance which under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury. An Oregon officer is justified in using deadly physical force when it is necessary to defend the peace officer or another person from the use or threatened imminent use of deadly physical force. Any person is justified in using deadly physical force when they reasonably believe that another person is using or about to use unlawful deadly physical force.
Okay, now did you hear that? That's pretty contradictory as well. Any person is justified in using deadly force if they feel like they're under threat from somebody else using deadly force. Well, if that logic holds, then I guess Lavoie would have been justified in defending himself after having already been under fire by these cops. So... this is just ridiculous. Anyway, I've got one more clip here, I think, related to this. And this is Lavoie Finicum's widow at a press conference where she talks about some of the things that the FBI and others have been saying in their releases regarding the justification of Lavoie's murder.
The news conference held earlier today in Bend, Oregon, to release the report of the investigation regarding my husband's death was to be expected. No surprises. The purpose of that announcement was for the state and federal agencies to continue to lay the foundation for their legal case. However, they have brought forward selective evidence. As in all such situations, there is another side to the story. According to an AP wire from Portland, Oregon, officials investigating the death of Robert Lavoie Finicum are ready to release results of the fatal shooting during a January 26 traffic stop while trying to arrest the rancher and others involved in the takeover of an Oregon wildlife refuge. However, the FBI video shows this was not a typical traffic stop. It was an ambush involving a roadblock on a blind curve along a lonely stretch of highway, a dead man's blockade, a kill stop, which is illegal. The AP continues. The FBI said Finicum was shot after reaching for a gun. We reject that statement. The FBI's aerial video was of poor quality, edited, and provided no audio. Our family asserts that he was shot with both hands up, and he was not reaching for anything at the time of the first shot. He was walking with his hands in the air, a symbol of surrender. When he reached down to his left, he was reaching to the pain of having been shot. I can hardly believe that a team of qualified law enforcers, officers, could look at the facts of this case and say that no criminal laws were violated. How could they have reached this decision in the face of evidence that clearly shows intent to kill my husband? We have talked with an independent investigator who has stated that the video provides a setup assassination. We have, many people, including my lawyers, have tried to prepare me for this. Be strong. Accept this with peace. But I do not think anything could prepare me to accept what is so clearly a finding that challenges the Constitution my husband died defending. I know that under the Constitution, the men who shot my husband to death while he was surrendering are entitled to due process of law, but they are not entitled to walk free and not have to face the same legal process that is a barrier to you or to me. They shot my husband. They left him lying in a snowbank with no medical assistance, no charges, no arrangements, no preliminary hearing, no indictment, no trial by a jury. And should they just walk free? It's just not right. The consolation I have had from thousands of Americans have seen and know the truth, and I believe that, as I do, that my husband was murdered intentionally and deliberately and with malice. My lawyer has assured me that we will seek justice in a different court under different circumstances, and I look forward to the day when these men do face a jury that is unbiased enough to return a fair verdict. After the funeral, rallies spontaneously began to organize in many states. The organizers counted possibly as many as 1,000 rallies took place throughout the country and in every state but Rhode Island. It has been asked how this movement got such momentum so quickly. When Americans heard the details of this story and how these American patriots who have no criminal record and who have stood on the same interpretation of the U.S. Constitution as Justice Scalia have been treated, the actions of law enforcement and the FBI have shocked the conscience. Our Supreme Court has set as the standard guideline for practices of law enforcement that are unacceptable to our society as those that shock the conscience. A dead man's blockade with the intent to kill shocks the conscience. Shooting to kill with both hands up shocks the conscience. Violating the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, by placing Americans with no criminal record who are apparently guilty of defending the U.S. Constitution and the overreach of federal authorities into solitary confinement and then removing their constitutional right to bear arms are two examples of how elected and appointed officials in our court system, legislative body, and in the law enforcement are violating the rule of law.
So what do you think, Vicki? Got any comments on anything she said there?
No, I completely agree with everything she said. And it was a well-prepared statement because she used the same term that the judge used in the Hammond case, you know, about shocking the conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like that they... case that our government, our law enforcement agencies are they're really not acting as American law enforcement, I think.
Yeah.
And that's really what they should be doing. I hope that that's what they're doing.
Well, justify,
because I'm not sure that they are, actually.
Well, they're certainly not operating as peace officers.
Mm-mm.
Which is exactly what they should be operating as.
Yeah.
You know, the question I have is, how do we get this message to the American people? Because
That's a good one.
The people on the ground are the ones that really need to be educated as to the Constitution and as to the importance of property rights in this country. You know, the concern I have here is that the young people in this country are following communists and thinking that it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, the groundswell of support for somebody like Bernie Sanders, who came right out and said, "Hey, I'm a democratic socialist. Isn't that wonderful?" You know, they're all in on the free government college, all these socialist programs, and they don't realize, or even care maybe, that socialism is the main ingredient to communism.
Well, we have an entire generation of young people that were raised under eco-fascism, with communism being the result, and that's my main takeaway from the studying of the President's Council for Sustainable Development that I've been doing.
Yeah.
Is that it really was a communist takeover.
Well, you know, the United Nations...
And it was driven by the environmental groups. You know, Al Gore, of course, was an environmentalist, supposedly, but he was more on the tech side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you get the convergence of technology and radical environmentalism.
And it's important to point out that under a communist system, the means of production, the land, is controlled by the state. You don't have any property. Everybody, you know, the whole idea of communism is that everything is supposed to be fair, right? So in order to make everything fair, you got to have all property has got to be managed. It's got to be controlled. It's got to be centrally distributed. If there is anything, it's got to be centrally controlled and distributed. So land rights doesn't factor into the communist system.
Well, apparently in the 1972 Stockholm Declaration, you know, the Conference on the Human Environment, they said that property is a special kind of asset and it has to be controlled, that there basically shouldn't be any private property. All property should be owned by the state.
Yeah, and that's pretty telling. You know, knowing what we know about the United Nations and how it was founded by communists.
Well, and in agreements like the La Paz Agreement that I've talked about on your program, in the first paragraph, they always refer back to the 1972 Stockholm Declaration. Well, in a legal document, when you refer to another document, that is the same thing as incorporating the document in its entirety in that new agreement. So over the years, all these treaties that our government has signed where they have referenced a previous agreement, they have been building, you know, just stacking on, piling on. And you know, if it's a treaty, it becomes the law of the land.
Yeah.
So there you go. I mean.
Yeah, and what you're talking about with regard to the La Paz Agreement, that's the what they used to call Border 21, the Border 2020 thing now. They keep renaming it the U.S.-Mexican border, this regional area. And I always say, why would you want to have a region along the border? But to blur the border to the point where you eventually eliminate the border.
Well, it kind of erases the border because of the area in the La Paz Treaty created an international zone under the daily management of the Environmental Protection Agency. And because it's an international treaty, it's under the supervision of the State Department.
Right.
And I realized, you know, in my researching things, that really this whole strategy of regionalization really goes to the State Department. Because every international zone that you're talking about in our country, whether it's a foreign trade zone or the international zone, or the Pacific Northwest Economic Region that Idaho is participating in, it involves the State Department.
Right. Yeah, and why doesn't anybody talk about the State Department is what I want to know, other than us, and, you know, maybe one or two other people in the Patriot Movement. I don't really, even in the Patriot Movement, I don't listen very much to anybody, but at least not to very many people.
Well, I never really thought about the State Department my whole life, you know, because I was always under the impression that they were diplomats and they did diplomatic things. Well, not true. When right. Tim Worth had been a senator and... I don't know, many positions. He was actually on the airport board that approved the plan for the Denver airport.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's a total freak psychopath,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned. But I think he got confused about what the mission of the State Department was in terms of operating outwardly. And... he talked about developing constituencies, networks of constituencies domestically.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned refugees. I think he mentioned migrants, but I'm not. Or he definitely mentioned the environmental networks. Okay, so basically, I consider that treason.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, what they did is they turned foreign policy on the people of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when we, a couple months ago or earlier last year, whenever, when we were opposing, we still are opposing, refugee resettlement in Idaho, a State Department official, a couple of them came out to Idaho to make a presentation. I mean, they should not be lobbying the people of Idaho for refugees. I mean, geez, that's treason by definition.
Yeah, it just floors me that there's not more outcry against this, because, you know, I've said repeatedly on the show here that this is how you flip a country. I mean, you don't have to really change anything constitutionally or anything else. If you flood the country with foreigners, you by definition, you've changed the makeup of the country to the point where the native people are outnumbered. Eventually, you don't have to do a thing, but those people don't share your values. They don't have an understanding of what the government is all about, what it should be about. And consequently, eventually these people become decision makers. If you give them the right to vote, which the government here is doing now, insanely so. I mean, this is so blatant, what's happening here. It's just, I shake my head. I keep waiting, Vicky, to wake up from this nightmare. I keep waiting to wake up.
It's an occupation of our country. It's just that the mainstream media, I don't know whether they've been bought off or they're operatives in this communist takeover, but even our governing officials, you know, our state representatives, they've all been silenced somehow. I don't know if it's blackmail. I don't know. I'm sure a big percentage of them are communists themselves, but I mean, it makes absolutely no sense that they would bring in populations of people that whose culture is completely opposite of ours. I mean, their culture is not compatible with Western culture.
No, and the thing is, with legal immigration, which we had in this country, well, since the country was founded, I suppose, you at least have a vetting process, you have an educational process that the people wanting to come here have to go through in order to understand and to make them, basically, to put them into a position where they're able to assimilate. They're able to understand what we're all about here and whether or not they fit into that whole equation. And if they don't, they're not going to make it. They won't be allowed in. You know, and they can appreciate it once they get here. You know, but now they've completely thrown that whole process out the window in favor of just an absolute flood, a tide of migrants. And it's happening everywhere. It's happening in Canada, and as we see, it's happening in Europe as well. It's all over the place. Tell you what, we got the top of the hour break. We'll start again with hour number two, continue this discussion. Folks, you're welcome to call in if you want. 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-6-GOVERN. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Vicki Davis is here. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com. That's www.governamerica.com. And also Vicky's websites. ChannelingReality.com is the older one where she has her older research. And the more recent stuff is found at TheTechnocraticTyranny.com. That's TheTechnocraticTyranny.com. And we have them linked up with ours, so you can just click across if you want to. But anyway, TheTechnocraticTyranny.com. And she has a lot of information there. Including the government overthrow of the people, which she is referencing today as she does her work going back to the President's Council on Sustainable Development, and the outcome of which we're living with in a major way today. The onslaught of Agenda 21, what they're calling now Agenda 2030, the control of all land, the redesign or reinvention of government, and the and the redesign and reorientation of cities, Vicki. We're seeing that happen all across the country, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. And that was part of President's Council on Sustainable Development. That was Al Gore's pet project. Called them the Community Empowerment Boards. Well, that was part of my research on Trojan Triangles. It was the financing for it. Mm-hmm. And when I traced the financing for it, that's when I found those community empowerment grants. And Chicago, Illinois was one of the first cities to get, it was the first city to get the community empowerment money and the Community Empowerment Board, which really is a fascist management board. I mean, this President's Council on Sustainable Development video that I found is 4 hours long. And I wow. swear, every couple minutes, I would like to go through it and stop and talk about what they just said. I'm going to be able to do that with another person because there is so much there. Everything is there. The seeds of everything are there in that meeting.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can dissect it on the show sometime.
I'd love to, but it's a 4-hour meeting.
Obviously, we don't have 4 hours. We have 3 hours.
You know, like 3 or 4 programs to do it.
Well, we might have to cut it down a little bit. And that's what we try to do here is take long things and cut them down to bite-sized pieces so people can understand. You know, speaking of cutting things down to bite-sized pieces, we're talking about the reorientation and redesign of cities. I found it interesting. Last Monday, PBS NewsHour did a feature story on towns getting it right. Now, you know, when PBS is telling you that towns are getting it right, that pretty much means towns are not getting it right. Basically, this was nearly a 10-minute commercial for sustainable development. Now, I cut it down just to a few minutes to get the pertinent parts in there, but I'd like to get your take on it. They focus on Greenville, South Carolina. They mentioned a number of...
We have been the victims of a massive propaganda campaign. They in the PCSD, mm-hmm. they called it public linkage, dialogue, and outreach.
Well, that's a mouthful.
And it was, in fact, to change the way that people think.
Yeah.
You know, you've heard, what's his name, the former attorney general, talk about how they really needed to brainwash people about thinking differently about guns. Mm-hmm. Well, they set out...
Yeah, Eric Holder.
Yeah.
We got some Skype issues. You're at times coming and going, so people bear with us. It's still better quality than the phone line, so... But anyway, it's been doing
it. Big Brother is about to take us out.
Well, I think it's more like, you know, the old fiber optics here are stretched.
Okay. Well, anyway, I've noticed in this area that there is a massive propaganda campaign. And I don't know if you've ever paid any attention to the public service announcements by the ad council.
Yeah, from time to time.
Well, that's the thing, you know. If you listen to a conservative talk show host, you're listening to the host, but then when the commercial comes on, your attention goes other places. But those messages are still coming into your brain.
Well, I can't possibly listen to conservative talk show hosts. I can't listen to any talk show host almost.
We have one here.
Well, you might have you might have a good one locally, if you're lucky. But you know, most of the local ones are, you know, pretty much parrots of the national ones. And I don't know. I just can't. Once in a while you get one that might be saying some good stuff. A lot of those don't last. I notice either somebody gets to them and says, "Listen, you need to shut your mouth," or they get fired outright. You know, that's happened. you know, more times than we care to count.
Well, that's true, except that they, in this town, our local talk show host talks about local issues, and mm-hmm. He's a relatively new talk show host, but he was attacked almost immediately on the refugee issue, because he started talking about it.
Well, he's a racist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're talking against the refugees, you're a racist.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So. But the radio station really picked up a lot of listeners just because of him. So yeah. They're kind of like between a rock and a hard spot.
Well, and
but
that's,
I'm sure
that's,
they're
that's
trying
the whole
to
point.
Mitigate with those ad council ads that they put on. So
if people, you know, media outlets that tell the truth, I'll tell you what, Russia Today, this RT that's funded by the Kremlin, I've become a fan. When they first came on the scene, I said, well, you know, they're saying a lot of things that are true, although I don't agree with them on everything. It's interesting, but I couldn't get out of my mind the fact that this outfit is a Kremlin-funded propaganda mouthpiece. And yet, I look at that, and I think this is really the organization, the media organization, that the national media here in the United States should be saying all of the stuff that they're covering.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're telling the truth in a foreign country. Look how long the United States had Voice of America, you know, bringing truth to people behind the Iron Curtain. Well, it's essentially the same thing. RT is bringing truth behind the Iron Curtain.
Well, and does Voice of America really bring truth? Maybe some, but... they also bring in an awful lot of propaganda, too. You know, so anyway, I wanted, speaking of propaganda, getting back to this PBS thing, I wanted to share this with you and see what you think here, because they cover a lot of different things regarding what's going on in the reinvention of government in Greenville, South Carolina.
In a search for places that have grappled with challenges, economic or political, the Fallows have made extended visits to about 25 cities for the project.
The Falls are a really nice way to link the past and the present.
A prime example, Greenville, South Carolina. Once known for the textile industry, its mills line the Reedy River in the heart of the city.
Now, they got this park that goes through the city center. Okay, which is just a big component of Agenda 21, is having parks in the cities, green spaces, Vicki.
Now the mills are long gone or repurposed, but the river remains at the center of the community, lined by hotels and restaurants as it flows through a stunning urban park that's a magnet for tourists and locals alike. The evolution was no accident.
We reinvented the downtown just...
Now, did you catch that? Reinvented.
Reinvented the local economy.
Knox White, mayor of Greenville for more than 20 years and a chief architect of the city's redevelopment, says city fathers set out decades ago to plan for the future.
In the 1970s, when textiles were still very viable, the leadership in Greenville very intentionally decided that we needed to diversify. They brought in and recruited companies like General Electric, and today GE is a major presence here, and that put us in really good stead, because later the textile industry would collapse.
I think they're very self-conscious about what they're doing in Greenville, and also aware that these things aren't going to be decreed from on high.
It's just in part of our DNA of how we operate.
Remaking Greenville took government
that is
and business
so much
working
baloney.
Together.
Yeah, did not be dictated from on high. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. It's just in their DNA. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, hey, think globally, act locally, right?
Nancy Whitworth, Greenville's Director of Economic Development.
The public-private partnership of working together, the city and the county, you see that every day in sort of how we approach dealing with companies that we try to bring into Greenville.
An active local government pushing incentives like tax breaks and favorable zoning have made so-called public-private partnerships possible, both in developing the downtown and in luring major manufacturers to the area, like BMW and Michelin. These companies provide tens of thousands of jobs and bring an international influence to this small southern city.
It is definitely conservative, by and large.
Danielle Vinson teaches political science at nearby Furman University.
We have pockets of Democrats in the city limits particularly, but everywhere else is very Republican. And so our senators are Republican, all of our congressional delegation up here is Republican.
Vinson says the government's partnership with business may seem inconsistent with Republican philosophy, but it's a way to make things work.
When you start talking about ideology, it's good in theory and you can argue about it at the national level. But when you get to the local city and county level, you've got tangible issues that have to be addressed.
There's no question Greenville's economy is booming. Half a dozen cranes dot the skyline as new hotels, condos, and office buildings multiply. But some are asking if the benefits have reached all of Greenville's residents, about 15% of whom are poor.
How fast is gentrification happening here?
It's happening very rapidly, even in my neighborhood.
Chandra Dillard is a Democratic state representative from Greenville.
I've received letters at my home saying, do you want to sell? I mean, there is pressure against the neighborhood.
Okay, so what do you think so far?
What they're doing is the standard plan. The zones are urban renewal zones. What happened with the President's Council, the reinvention of government, is that they brought all the agencies of government together to be able to produce coordinated plans, coordinated grant programs.
Mm-hmm.
And they reach down to the county level. And basically, they're buying off our county officials. And since our political system begins at the county level, it's been these programs have been in place long enough that they've created their own political base. The federal government has their own political base,
mm-hmm,
that they bought through the funding that flows to the counties.
Yeah, so that's what I thought you were talking about when you said they bought off the county officials. You're talking about the grant money that flows into the counties.
Yes, and yes.
But it's really at every level, isn't it? I mean, the states get grant money, and the cities themselves get grant money, don't they?
I don't know how much, but the way that it's set up with the Economic Development Administration, that's where you have your public-private partnership,
mm-hmm,
and so you get money flowing in both directions. But I think the majority of the money flows to the counties.
Yeah.
At least it does out here in the West.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah, and then you have the International Code Council, which these counties are implementing the international codes, such as the International Property Maintenance Code and various other things, which just absolutely put all of the control into the hands of the code enforcement officer. And so, literally, they can take anybody's property they want by nitpicking everything to death.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I found with the International Building Code in one of the case documents with the Idaho Public Utilities Commission. So the Utilities Commission told Idaho Power to request to lobby the state for this International Building Code.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is just turned upside down. Okay, here's another thing, too. A lot of money that flows into the county level is from HHS, all of the health and welfare money,
mm-hmm,
to run the state health agencies and the programs. A lot of that money comes to the counties and not to the state.
Well, and what role does education play in this? You know, you mentioned the Trojan Triangle thing. You know, finishing us up, this Greenville, South Carolina thing, they go into their program of education. You're going to love this.
At the Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering, you heard that right, elementary school, these kids get a head start on math and science.
These were the tiniest little engineers from pre-K through grade 5.
Oh, aren't they cute little tiny engineers?
And yeah. They were starting off with in technology and engineering infused into their baby curriculum.
And the South Carolina Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities, a public boarding school, gives high school students from across the state an opportunity to pursue excellence. Still, much work remains to spread the new opportunities and benefits among all of Greenville's residents. And much of that work falls to the church.
Welcome to the Union of Socialist Soviet States of America, Vicki.
Yep, you're exactly right. That's what it is. And those little kids are fortunate to be in a place where there are large corporations to fund programs, but here in Twin Falls, Idaho, and in probably most places around in the country, I mean, what do the young people here have to look forward to? A career in air conditioning, you know, heating and air conditioning maintenance, and or changing bedpans, you know, as a nurse's assistant, or I mean, the whole thing, it is the Soviet system of polytechnical education.
Yeah, I placed a call into Charlotte Iserbeet this past week because that, you know, hearing this, my mouth just, it's like, this is so in your face, you know, and yet the problem is the American people don't know. They look at this and they think, oh, isn't that wonderful? You know, they got industry. Here's a booming town. You know, what's not to love? What's
right.
Not
well,
to love?
And they bring out the little kids that are genius level, mm-hmm. that would do well no matter where they are, no matter where you put them. But most children are not geniuses. They are not going to be a concert violinist,
right,
or a mathematician, or, you know, it's just not going to happen.
Well, and you bring up another point. What wasn't mentioned in that report? You know, there's a whole world of things. I mean, they focused a little bit on the gentrification, you know, and everything, but there is a lot of other things. There's a lot of downsides to doing this. We've talked before on this show, these incentives for these corporations. A lot of times, you know, as soon as the incentives expire, because a lot of times they're for a limited period of time, then the corporation basically holds that over the city's head and says, all right, you know what, we're going to go somewhere else now. We're going to do something else. And, you know, it creates problems with the budget and everything else in the state. At least that's what's happened here in Michigan.
Right. Well, and the thing that I object to most of all is that it's not fair. It's not right to these children. They are not going to be whole people.
Well, and the corporate incentives for the big multinationals isn't fair for the locally owned and operated businesses either.
Well, that's very true. Yes, we have a number of cases of that here in Twin Falls. There's one big dairy that gets subsidized labor, and we have other dairies that don't.
Yeah.
You know, so they can't really compete with that.
Yeah, you're giving special favors to one business over another. I mean, that ain't right.
No.
You know.
And that's the deal with those zones, you know. The company that's here that's called Chobani, it's a yogurt factory. The guy came from Turkey. And he's bringing in Muslims, by the way, to work in his factory. But when they first started talking about having that plant, and it was the economic developers that brought that plant in here, It cost the taxpayers of Twin Falls $25 million. This guy was supposed to be a billionaire. Mm-hmm. He only put in $18,000.
Yeah, I remember you wrote up a whole thing on that.
Yeah, well, I did a lot of research on it, and I have a lot of research, but I really didn't write about it too much because it was too close to home, and I was afraid to, honestly. I was afraid to because of who he is, where he came from, and the conditions under which he came to have be in a position where to open that factory.
Interesting.
It's dirty.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, was that an EB-5 situation?
No, he was a student. He came as a student.
Student visa.
Yeah, and he married a Turkish doctor, and I think that was how he was able to stay in the country. Otherwise, you know, he'd have had to go back. But he applied for money at the Fulton County Economic Development Administration in New York. And I have an article that says when he walked into their office, he didn't have a green card, he didn't have any money, he had nothing but an idea. So it was the Economic Development Administration that made arrangements for him to be able to go into business there. Mm. So, you know, there's something really, really wrong with that.
Yeah, indeed. Let's go to the phone lines. You're welcome to call in if you want, folks. 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-646-8376 is the toll-free number. Waiting in the wings, we have John in Tennessee. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. You know, I'm listening to this clip. I guess my ears are different because I hear things like city fathers and the hair on the back of my neck stands up, and city planners and the hair on the back of my neck stands up. But if that's not enough, then I hear Greenville right down the road from Furman University. I wonder how many people realize that Furman is a Jesuit university. This is going way back, Vicki. This is going somewhere that you've been talking about that I know of for several years, but the news isn't mentioning it. You know, I don't know. Am I off base?
No, you're very, very astute. The Trojan triangles, that idea actually comes from the Vatican. The Vatican is an inland port. And that the idea of international zones within the borders of countries came about as a result of the 1921 Barcelona Declaration. And I'm not sure if the Vatican was involved in that or not, but when Italy made the agreement with the Pope on the Vatican, the idea was to have the Vatican be an independent city-state. And they actually have their own maritime flag. That's under maritime law, by the way.
Go ahead, John.
While they're taking away the independent nation status of the states in this country, you also mentioned that they're taking the brilliant children or the genius children that would do well anywhere, and that's, Vicki, that's what they're afraid of. These children are more than just bright or genius or brilliant. They can become a threat to all of this if they don't take control of their upbringing and their training and their programming. Because let's face it, your mind, and my mind, I believe with all my heart, is nothing more than the most powerful computer ever created. We really are, because if it wasn't for someone's intelligence and their brain power, you wouldn't have the processors and the programs and the computers that you have. It's all because of man's ability, God-given ability. So they're going to make good little technocrats if we take care of them and we train them in the way that they should go, because the parents of so many, Vicki, have neglected the training, the instruction from the book that says train up your child in the way they should go. When they're old, they won't depart from it. So if the parents aren't going to do it, then the people that really believe that, like Hillary said, those children are not yours, take the village to raise a child, they're going to raise the children. The Vatican believes that they own us all anyway. Mm-hmm. They pledged our labor.
You know, so John, the fact that you said making them into little technocrats and everything, I want you to hang around before over the break, because when we come back, I've got a clip that Steve O'Brien sent me, and I think this is really going to be chilling. This gives you a demonstration of just how far this technocratic thing has gone. These people are freaks. Anyway, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Bottom of the hour break. This is Govern America.
Is this our country anymore?
Welcome back to the broadcast. That's really the question. Is it? Well, if you don't claim it, it won't be. And that's the bottom line. That's Bruce Ballett bringing us back into the broadcast here. This is Govern America. You're welcome to call in. 1-844-646-8376 is the number. That's 1-844-646-8376. John in Tennessee is on the line right now. We have Vicki Davis here as well. And I would like to play this clip for you folks and get your take on this. This demonstrates how quickly the technocratic movement is really taking hold. I remember back when I first stumbled across these people, I had never heard from anyone. I discovered a group called the I don't even remember what their name was, but I wrote an article about it because it was something that alarmed me so greatly. But that was around probably sometime, I'm guessing around 2003.
Was it H2?
No.
H plus.
No, maybe it'll come to me after a while. They had a particular name, and they were described as optimists. But at any rate, these were transhumanist people, and it's alarming that people can have this idea in their head that this is a good thing. Anyway, listen to this report. This came from National Public Radio.
They call themselves body hackers, people who say they're pushing the boundaries of implantable technology. By that, I mean they insert everything from computer chips to LED lights into their bodies. This week in Austin, about 300 body hackers gathered to share ideas and techniques at a first-of-its-kind conference in the U.S. NPR's Ader Peralta went there to explore the ethics and philosophy behind this cyborg movement.
Emil Grofstra is sitting in the middle of an exhibit hall filled with booths on everything from exercise equipment to meditation techniques to brain scanning caps. He's getting ready to implant microchips in a long line of people. The guy who's next in line is sporting a mohawk.
You're doing right hand?
Yeah, right.
Ready?
A huge needle pierces his hand, and a chip that's a bit bigger than a grain of rice slips under his skin. The RFID chips can hold encrypted information, and their unique ID number can be used to open doors or unlock your smartphones. That's what the guy with the mohawk wants to do.
No longer do I have to worry about the thumbprint or putting in a password.
Across the way, Sasha Rose, who was working at a meditation booth, wonders if it's a good idea to embed personal data into your body.
That's why it's crazy to me, actually. It's because people are just willing to just line up and go, yeah, stick that in me.
That night, I meet with Emil Grafstra, who is chipped and has a magnet in his finger that he says lets him sense some magnetic fields. He's outside a club with Ryan O'Shea, whose company makes LED devices that light up under the skin. Grafstra says we live in a new world where technology can improve the human body instead of just fixing what's broken.
Like a patient may someday come, you know, very soon and say, my eye is totally fine, but I want like an eye that can see infrared and I want an eye that can zoom.
O'Shea says that people are only freaked out about these devices because they're not thinking about them logically.
I think once people realize, oh, it's okay that my grandma has a pacemaker, a magnet's much less invasive than that, people are going to start to accept this. You know, the era of transhumanism, I would say, is here. So let's accept that and then see where that logically takes us.
Inside the club, there's a drone hovering above the dance floor, and Tony Salvador is at a table near the bar. He's an anthropologist for Intel who studies social values and how they affect technology. He says that sometimes technology moves too fast, and accepted social boundaries, not to mention the law, don't keep up. That's part of the reason, he says, that people who wore Google Glass were called glass holes with a G.
It created a social misunderstanding. You didn't know what was going on.
He says that it's up to philosophers to help set those boundaries, and they're letting us down.
There are too few of them, they're too esoteric, and we're not actually addressing the moral and ethical issues and saying, these are the right ways to go.
So later, of course, I call a philosopher. I ask Alva Noy, a Berkeley professor who's written books on cyborgian naturalness, and also blogs for NPR, about society's tolerance for artificially enhancing the body.
We don't condemn people for using glasses to see better, but we do start to think taking speed to cope with your work life is questionable.
But Noing says society may never settle on just where we draw the line.
We may reach consensuses and then lose them. Just as there was once a consensus where it was okay to smoke to function effectively, and now we have the consensus that increasingly it's not okay to do that.
Back outside the convention center in Austin, I meet with a guy who's considered the rock star of the body hacking movement. He's Neil Harbison, a colorblind artist from Barcelona, who has a camera screwed to the back of his skull. The lens arcs over his head and dangles in front of his face. He calls it an antenna because it detects the color in front of him and translates it into musical notes.
The traffic light now is A. It was F a moment ago.
When he gave the keynote address, he said the first time he heard those colors while dreaming, he felt truly cyborg. Now he identifies not as human, but as a, quote, cybernetic organism.
If we define ourselves as organisms, suddenly our group is wider. We are in the same level as an insect or as a cat or as a plant.
But he's well aware of how the world perceives him. On more than one occasion, he says people have tried to rip off his antenna. I ask him if he's ever thought about just taking it off.
To me, it's much stronger, the wish to sense what surrounds me, than the fact that people keep annoying me.
He says he hopes that in the future, as others get new senses, he'll be considered normal.
These people are absolutely... I couldn't help. I just couldn't help but laugh when they said he rips his antenna off. You know, it would be funny if it wasn't so.
Will do anything for attention. There was a guy in front of the Capitol yesterday. He had a hat on that was a boot. I mean, the minute I saw him, I thought of Das Boot. I haven't read that book. I know it has something to do with East Germany or Soviet Union or something, but this guy says he's president of the United States. He was dressed up in pajamas. He had on a red cape. I mean, you know, total whack job.
Well, all these people are whack jobs, but are they just doing this for attention or are they serious about it? I can't help but believe some of these people are actually serious.
I think you can be both serious and totally seriously nuts.
Yeah, well, I vote for the latter in this case. It's incredible.
Well, maybe he was making a political statement, you know, like he's got the boot on his head. I mean, I'd like to have a hat boot someday.
Well, you know, you may not need it. You may have the boot stamping on the face forever, as George Orwell put it.
That's right. Just step out of line, and you'll get your boot.
You'll get your boot hat. We got your boot hat right here, buddy.
Well, you know, to hear these people, they're wanting normalcy. Did I understand that he had an antenna screwed to the back of his head?
Yeah, he had a camera. Didn't they say he had a camera screwed to his skull?
Yeah, it translated color to sound. Mm. So, and he wants it to be normal. Well, we have failed miserably somewhere, guys, in bringing people to wanting abnormality to be recognized as, you know, and I guess that's the way that it's supposed to be, because it's been a slow process. I can remember when I was in grade school, someone asked about, do you believe in Planned Parenthood? I guess it was junior high. I was so naive, I said, of course. You know, I think you ought to plan to have children. I didn't know what it was.
Right.
You know, but that's it. They make it innocuous that most people don't understand what it is that's even being talked about. When you talk about transhumanism, you're talking about the stuff that's going on in Austin. You know, I'm seeing so much that's going on. You remember back in 2009, Darren, I think we had just come to know one another a year or two before.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked about the whole transhuman issue. There were millions of web hits. If you typed in transhuman, you got transhuman law enforcement, transhuman crime scene investigation, transhuman rights. And I thought at that time, that was a few years down the road. Well, here we are now. These people are calling themselves cyborgs. They're embracing transhumanism. Then I can see why you're going to have transhuman law enforcement. You know, if it's not exactly human and it's not exactly machine, then how are you going to prove who did what? How are you going to enforce, transhuman rights? Think about this.
Well,
ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, here's the thing. They use the term in there that so-and-so identifies as such and such. You know, this goes, sounds an awful lot like the whole homosexual agenda. You know, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, you know, you name it. This whole anything goes type of thing with the sexuality. It's not hard to see why they would want to blur the lines, the gender lines, when you realize that robotics are gender neutral by their very nature. You know, so somebody identifying as something. Go ahead.
Well, maybe transhumanism is closer to existentialism than we really believe. You know, they identify as something that they're not. And Darren, you are because I am. And I am because you are. You're a creation. Since I'm a god, you're a creation of my mind. And you only exist because I wish for you to be here. And if I want to identify as an elephant man or a pony boy, then since I'm the ruler of my world and I'm a god in a fleshly body, I can say and do anything I want, and you have no reason, no ability to disagree. You've got to accept me.
Well, what I want to know is, where does the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Health fit into this whole equation?
Well, they have to ignore all of that, because the whole...
Are you there?
Is a population control agenda. Because, if you're transgender, you're not going to reproduce, right?
Mm-hmm.
And homosexuals, if they marry each other, they don't reproduce either. The only way you can have children is through heterosexual union, whether it takes place in a petri dish or naturally.
Yeah, John.
Not exactly, because the Chinese in mice several years ago had been tweaking chromosomes. So, how far off is that from humanity that we'll be able to take two men or two women tweak a chromosome, put it into an artificial womb, whether it's a human womb or a mechanical womb, and create an offspring that has the DNA of both fathers. That's what they're working on. They want to destroy Christianity, destroy what marriage is, destroy the American family, or even the, you know, the God's intent for a family, a man and a woman.
Yeah.
They want to destroy it.
Yeah, and they're doing totally a pretty good job of it. Well, they know that the family is
the backbone.
If there
is a God, then he will, at that point, destroy the human race because they will be destroying his creation.
Well, I don't think God has to do it. I think the human race is pretty much doing a good job of destroying themselves. Mm. You know, when you start mutilating yourself, putting cameras in your head and LED lights under your skin. I mean, you go to the page of this, and I'll put it in the show notes. There's pictures of people actually having these LEDs glowing under their skin. It's sick. It's really, really sick. We got another call on the line. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and add this caller. Hey, caller, come on in. Who do we have?
Oh, hi, this is Karen from Northern Minnesota.
Hey, Karen, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Enjoying your program, and just had to make a couple comments about the transhumanism that I have observed as I've worked for state, county, all that. And when I first started working, it was you would go to the personnel office. Well, now they changed it to human services. And then you've got Health and Human Services, which is our Cook County Health and Human Services. So I'm saying, well, if it isn't human, then what are they referring to, aliens? Well, then you've got, you know, when you go onto the computer and you access a website and you want to forward it to someone by email? They put in these mumble-jumbled numbers and symbols, and they're asking you if you are human. Have you ever done that?
I've never had anything ask me if I'm human. Oh, yeah,
it says right on there when you go to email.
Interesting.
They ask you, you have to put in what you see, and these numbers and letters are moving constantly.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
To prove that.
That's a spam block.
Yeah, the CAPTCHA thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have that on our site. It's mainly because they have to do that because of the otherwise what it is there are people who program bots. They call them bots, and they go around the web making fake accounts on various servers and spamming comments and things like that, and so you have to try to do something to foil these spam bots. The problem is the bots are getting more and more sophisticated all the time. So as a result of that, you got to make the CAPTCHA more and more sophisticated to the point where it becomes difficult as a person, as a regular human being, to be able to pass the test. So, that's a problem.
Okay.
Took me a while to figure out what you're talking about there.
Well, let me add this. You know, I've been to websites, or I've made phone calls before, where you get someone that sounds just like a human being, but for some reason you can sense something. So before I answer any questions, I said, "Am I talking to a human being?" And they'll ask the question again, and I'll say, "Well, am I speaking with a human?" And they will not answer you, and eventually, you know you're talking to a robot. You know, very sophisticated, sounds like a man, sounds like a woman, but it's a robot. And they're not programmed to say yes, because they can't say yes, I'm a human. Well, what do you, they'll say something like, well, would I be anything else? And I want to know if you're a robot, and they won't answer.
So, you know, we played audio on this.
Than we realized.
You remember that audio we played on the show? It's been several years ago now, Vicky, where that robot was insisting that, yes, I am human. You know, And it was really bizarre, to say the least.
Yeah, it's very creepy. But I've gotten those calls too, John, where they start out with asking you a question, and you answer it, and then they proceed with their pitch. And if you're not really, like the first couple times I got it, I really wasn't paying much attention. And then at some point I realized that I was talking to a robot, a recording, you know, that, but I don't really talk to them. I just hang up, you know, because I don't do surveys. I just don't really interact with people on the phone anymore.
Yeah, I don't. I pretty much, whenever I get one of those, I pretty much just tell them. Well, more often than not, 800 numbers.
One time.
I pick up and.
I'm sorry. I did it one time, and they finally, it just said, "You ask too many questions," and they hang up. You ask too many questions.
That's kind of fun. Maybe I'll try it. Maybe I'll do that.
It is fun. It is absolute fun.
Well,
all right. I'm listening. I'll be quiet.
All right. We'll talk later, John. God bless you. Karen, did you have anything else?
Bye-bye.
Karen?
Oh, I just wanted to tell you my experience firsthand with Obamacare. And I was to the doctor recently, and they gave me the same spiel, all these questions, personal questions, and they asked me if I had a husband, and I said, yeah. I said, you should have that on record. Well, what's his name? And I told them, and she says, and what are his health concerns? I says, that's not why I'm here, and that's none of your business.
Wow.
And so then they went on, how do you drink? How many drinks a day do you have? Would you say one, two, a week, a month, a year? I said, that's not why I'm here, and I'm not going to answer any more of these irrelevant questions.
Did they ask you if you have any guns in the house?
So, no, but the other one that they always ask you, have you ever been depressed?
Oh, yeah.
And then they want to know what health supplements you're on, and do you feel that afraid to be alone by yourself, and all these intrusive questions.
Yeah,
they need to tag you as having a mental problem. That's what they're doing.
Right.
Oh, that's coming, because Michelle is pushing for every child and adult to be mentally health screened.
Right, and it wasn't just Michelle. It was the Bush administration.
Oh, well.
Well, it started under the, you know, the New Freedom, very Orwellian named New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. Started under Bush, George W. Bush, I believe, Vicki. And go ahead. You were going to say something?
Well, the healthcare system, there is no Hillary Care, Obamacare, you know, Bush features to it. It's the same healthcare that was system, the redesign of healthcare that was started under George Herbert Walker Bush. He's the one that initiated the project to begin with. Mm-hmm. And it has just progressed phase by phase by phase over these many administrations. And if you look at the healthcare programs that passed under, you'll see that they were just building on what they had previously built under the Clinton administration.
Yeah, they lay the foundation and they build upon it. And it's, like you said, the guard changes, the quote-unquote guard, but it reminds me of what Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown, Carol Quigley, said in his book, we can just vote the rascals out, and yet nothing really changes. Nothing of substance really changes.
That's right. They change the rhetoric, but they don't change the programs. The programs stay the same. They might give more focus on a different aspect of the program, one where they can formulate a message that is acceptable to either Democrats or Republicans, you know, depending on who's in power. But the program itself does not change.
Well, and I think the mistake people make, Karen and Vicky, is that people think that Obamacare really is supposed to be about health care. What Obamacare is really about is information. It's about data. Because as you go forward with this communitarian program, suddenly, if you can make it where it's tailored to health, and you can make the cost of health, so-called health care, be dependent upon what everyone is doing and the behaviors. You know, suddenly everybody's behavior becomes everybody else's business.
Yes.
And so, really, it all boils down to, as everything seems to anymore, control. And you can't have absolute control without having absolute information. And there you go back to Agenda 21. There's a full chapter in Agenda 21 dealing with healthcare. There's a full chapter in Agenda 21, Chapter 40, dealing with information for decision-making. So databases are very important to the overall plan.
Oh, the technology and systems are the plan. That is the total plan. That is the total global objective. They just, here in Idaho, they just recently announced a new program to help people that are on the low end of the economic ladder. They're going to give them case managers for their health care.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really monitors. I mean, and if you get right down to the bottom line, if you drill right down to what they're really doing, they're trying to eliminate population, but they're going to monetize poor people in the process.
Absolutely.
Actually monetize but they'll be doing experimentation on poor people.
I think we missed a little bit of that last statement. I'll tell you what, we got the break coming up here at the top of the hour. And Karen, do you have anything else?
Oh, no, that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. And folks, you're welcome to call in if you'd like to join in. It's 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-646-8376. Or 1-844-6-GOVERN. You want to remember it that way. Hour number 3 of Govern America straight ahead. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. ChannelingReality.com. That's ChannelingReality.com or TheTechnocraticTyranny.com. Those are her websites. And I highly recommend that you go there and read and study. She's got a lot of external links. She links to the real documentation. It's deep, deep research, ladies and gentlemen. And this is all stuff that's relevant to everyday life in America. Increasingly, we are suffering the onslaught of this global village, for lack of a better way of saying it. As they would describe it, it's a global village with a global economy and a global, global, global. And the more global we have, the more problems we have. And anyway...
Yeah, it's global communism.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And they will be eliminating... people who are, they will be eliminating people who don't meet the standard, and but in the interim, they'll use them for medical experimentation, for customized, personalized medicine.
Yeah, well, and some of that is already going on, as we see that there's a number of different people who are participating in laboratory, becoming laboratory animals for monetary gain in these pharmaceutical labs. where they give you all kinds of concoctions, and you know, you go in there hoping for the best.
Yeah. Well, you know, if a person is dying and they're absolutely going to die of a disease that medical science does not know how to halt, and if the person knowingly and completely understands what they're doing, I have no problem with experimental treatment.
Well, I guess in those cases you're right. The one thing I'm talking about is where they're paying perfectly healthy people to come in and sit and take these medications, these drugs, to see what they do. You know, and
yeah, I don't like that at all, because college students tend to do that.
Yeah, anybody who has who's in a dire financial situation, and
right, seeing what some of these, they've killed our economy, so there are a lot of people that are in that situation.
Yeah, yeah, it's a sad commentary, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Did you want to play some audio from Ron Brown? Did you want to comment on some of that? I do have that President's Council on Sustainable Development audio.
Sure.
Okay. So, anyway, this is Ron Brown. This is what, the first President's Council on Sustainable Development meeting, or was it, you know,
that? Well, it's the second one.
Okay.
But the first one, I suspect, probably was just to introduce everybody and, you know, talk about what the project, what their project, what their mission was. I'm not sure that it was recorded, you know, on C-SPAN, but this one is the second one. So
yeah, it's very early on in the process. And what's interesting about this is, as you listen to it, ladies and gentlemen, we've got the benefit now of many years of hindsight that we can look back over the years and see what they did from the time that he was. And basically, Vicky, what amazes me is he tells you exactly what they are doing. I mean, basically lays it out.
Yeah, it would be, you know what, it would not at the time when they did it. It's really only meaningful in hindsight, I think.
Yeah, it is. You're right. I mean, because the things he's talking about, I guess, really, if you were to sit there and listen to him, it does kind of sound a little bit like bureaucratic speak. But now looking back, it makes perfect sense. Anyway, this is Ron Brown, who was Clinton's, labor secretary, if I remember right? Or do I got that right?
Commerce.
Commerce.
He was Secretary of Commerce.
Knew it had something to do with business. All right, anyway, here we go.
See the second meeting of President Clinton's Council on Sustainable Development. The 25-member council...
I thought I had cut off the introduction.
...includes
part.
Business leaders and cabinet secretaries who met today to determine how to promote economic development while preserving the environment.
Good morning. We at the Department of Commerce are extraordinarily pleased to host this meeting this morning. We at the department take the work of the council extraordinarily seriously, because in a real sense, the Department of Commerce is the Department of Sustainable Development. The department is where trade and technology and environmental policies meet. There is a real confluence here. And where those goals work in harmony towards the prime mission of the department, which is to ensure and enhance the economic opportunity for all of the American people. They work in harmony because we absolutely and unequivocally reject the notion that economic growth and environmental goals are in some way incompatible. The leadership of the President and Vice President on these issues shows the falsity of the zero-sum game approach. We can have both. We can have growth, and we can be green, but only by rejecting the false dichotomies and the fragmented debate that have played Americans off against Americans. This administration is clearly about change, and the President has reminded us that we always make change our ally, that we must reject fear, and that we must embrace the opportunity that change brings. I believe that the work of the Council is just that kind of change. It demonstrates the opportunity that policies of sustainable development really offer the region and the nation the hope of the future. As this task force moves ahead, we expect the Department of Commerce to play a pivotal role. NOAA is the one key environmental agency in the department and is a very important agency of the federal government in reference to environmental concerns. Our own efforts here at the Department of Commerce on sustainable development are being led by our wonderful Undersecretary, Jim Baker. Jim understands the challenges we face and how those challenges can be surmounted. Indeed, he has already established the first Office of Sustainable Development in our federal government. It is headed by John Bullard, a former mayor of New Bedford, Massachusetts, who will focus precisely on the issues that we are discussing here today. The Technology Administration and NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, are actively involved in developing leading-edge environmental technology. The Eco Efficiency Task Force, which I co-chair, is working closely with these agencies in pursuit of practical and broadly applicable green technology. The Bureau of Economic Analysis has been involved in the creation of a green GDP, which is incorporating changes in our environmental quality into our standard measure of economic performance. The International Trade Administration is key to our efforts to create domestic economic growth and have a worldwide environmental impact by selling environmental technologies around the world. As proud as I am of Department of Commerce's involvement, it's important to remember that this task force is a real team effort. Our successes will be measured by our ability to, in fact, reinvent government and to work across governmental and private sector boundaries. To accomplish that end, the President has assembled in this council an extraordinarily talented group of people, relentlessly pragmatic and yet united in pursuit of a very important ideal, a prosperous and yet more beautiful and healthy nation. We have been given a tremendous opportunity to make America an even greater nation, and we all look forward to discovering with you new and important means of creating sustainable development, preserving our environment, and constructing an atmosphere for a growing economy.
Okay, I apologize for the noise, but, you know, of course, that being in the original, it was almost like his microphone wasn't working, so they cranked up all the other mics in the room, so you got all the ambient room noise there. But, you know, one thing that stood out in my mind, Vicky, about this is how he mentioned that the Department of Commerce is the Department of Sustainability. That's pretty important, isn't it?
It's hugely important.
Yeah.
Because when people talk about sustainability, they're thinking trees and, you know, renewable resources, mm-hmm. resources and things like that. But what Ron Brown was talking about was computer systems, the internet. And in fact, he was on the task force for eco-efficiency. And he was head of the Information Infrastructure Task Force. So they had plans all along to use the internet as a corporate backbone for management of our economy and natural resources and our people, everything,
mm-hmm.
using the internet to manage thing. And more than that, he was also working with the Soviets, as was Al Gore. Al Gore had a commission with a person from Russia. It was called the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission. And so they were transferring technology to the Soviets. They were giving our technology away to not only the Soviets, but to China, to all of our former enemies. It was like, here you go, you know, here is our defense.
Yeah.
So I think that's why he ended up with a bullet in his head and an airplane flying into a mountain,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah, it's You know, that's the thing, is that he laid it out there and talked about the reinvention of government. Our success is going to depend upon our ability to reinvent government. So he really laid it all out there. You know, the trade, the technology, the environmental policy.
He did. And their idea was that the environmental control technology would be developed here and it would be sold from the United States. Well, all electronics can be copied, you know, in places like China and sold for much cheaper than we can sell it. But what they use is something called market pull, which means they use the regulatory structure to implement a change in regulations that requires some kind of new environmental technology.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically force people to buy the technology, and it's public taxpayer dollars that pays to develop that technology, and then it is given to one of the scientists at one of the national laboratories that worked on it. So it's really public money for private profit.
Yeah, I was sorry about that. I was busy changing my microphone cable because I noticed there's a buzz in that other one. Anyway, it's a part of being your own tech. You know, you deal with things on the fly. So, anyway, this Katie McGinty, she's one of the people that were speaking in one of the videos that you posted. What's the significance of this Katie McGinty?
Well, the significance of Katie McGinty and David Bazzelli, who was vice president at Dow Chemical, is that Katie McGinty was a fellow for the American Chemical Society or something like that. Mm-hmm. But when I read about her, she was kind of like a social media guru who was in. She was kind of like the focal point for all the environmental groups. Okay, and in 1990, did I put that in there about that agreement in 1990 that Dow Chemical signed a partnership agreement with Ducks Unlimited, several of these environmental groups? They signed a partnership agreement to work together for the environment. Well, what that means really is that Dow Chemical was paying them. It was extortion money. Dow Chemical was paying them to leave them alone, but the environmental groups then took that money to go after other objectives, you see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see any mention of Dow Chemical in this particular article.
Okay, well, I'll send you the link so that you can post it in with the show notes.
Okay.
But that public-private partnership or partnership between a corporation and the environmental groups is hugely important. And I think that's really what tipped the balance for this President's Council on Sustainable Development.
Yeah.
To have all the environmental groups work with government and working with corporations.
I don't know if you want to play the... I got Katie McGinty and also Bruce Babbitt. I don't know if you want to play these or you think it would be worth the time.
Well, let's play Bruce Babbitt.
Okay. All right. We'll go ahead and play him then.
I think in some ways the most important things that are going on at the Interior Department are entirely outside the legislative arena. I think that's true in many areas of this administration. And the reason for that is that during the 1980s, we had in place an administration which was not interested in using environmental laws. And in an odd juxtaposition, the Congress responded by passing more and more laws as if somehow the grant of more and more authority might wake up the executive branch. Well, when we came in last year, we discovered an extraordinary backlog of very important possibilities. And it's been my experience in most areas that less important than new laws is setting about using the laws we have. Now, the most obvious and I think historically important example of that is the forest plan in the Pacific Northwest. I'm confident that this plan will go down in history as the beginning of one of the really important new chapters in environmental history, because here, for the first time in American history, federal agencies working together have broken the gridlock, not to protect one species, the spotted owl, but to protect hundreds of species, not just in one place, but in three states, an entire ecosystem running from Puget Sound down into Northern California in an unprecedented effort in which my agency, the Bureau of Land Management, working hand in hand with Secretary Espy and the United States Forest Service, the Environmental Protection Agency, scores of other agencies, has produced an ecosystem management plan of great complexity, demonstrating the concepts that Katie was talking about, that it is possible for federal agencies not to create gridlock, but to break it. And increasingly to understand that we can't treat environmental problems out on the back 40 in isolation. Everything relates. Someone once said when a butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon, it may create a snowstorm in Chicago. That's the concept that underlies this increasing understanding that there aren't any empty spaces anymore, and we can't go at it one crisis at a time. We must move this across the entire landscape. Just a couple more brief examples. The Florida legislature in Tallahassee last week passed an extraordinary piece of legislation, which in turn derives directly from the litigation that, together with EPA and other agencies, we settled last summer. It's a recognition that the Everglades National Park is dying. It's not dying because of the park rangers or any lack of effort on their part. It's because of what's happening beyond the park boundary, clear up north across the Everglades agricultural area, Lake Okeechobee, in the Kissimmee River Basin, extending clear up to Orlando. And it reflects, again, a concept which this administration brings to landscape management and environmental laws for the first time in history. It says you can't save the Everglades inside the park. You can save it only by dealing with the entire ecosystem, scores of federal agencies, the government of Florida, the South Florida Water Management District. If you want to save the Everglades, you've got to deal with the issues of urban expansion on the outskirts of Miami, with agriculture, with fishing in Florida Bay. And in a sense, you have to scale up, bring people together, cast away those old jurisdictional rivalries and saying we are operating in unison across an entire landscape. For those of you who are interested in California, there's another wonderful example going on in the Bay Delta of California. That's an issue which has been gridlocked since the days of Governor Jerry Brown clear back in the 1970s. It is now moving under the leadership of EPA and the Bureau of Reclamation toward, I think, the possibilities of a productive result extending all the way from San Francisco Bay up the San Joaquin and Sacramento rivers. Grazing is another contentious issue that I think illustrates much of the same. We've gone back together with the Forest Service across the entire western landscape and said we're going to have to break this old paradigm of command and control adversarial regulation, because if we're ever going to have a meaningful say in how 600-700 million acres of land are administered, we're going to have to get back into those communities, invite everybody to the table, and see if we can find a new paradigm in which all the stakeholders in public lands out there on the landscape are actually involved.
Okay, so I hope people are thinking about the fact that when they're listening to that, how does the ranchers fit into this whole situation? How do people who own, quote-unquote, large swaths of land fit into the whole sustainable development equation? You got Bruce Babbitt here, former Department of Interior Secretary, talking about, you know, basically introducing the whole concept of what has become known as linkages. You know, how nothing, you know, everything affects something else. And this is, you know, this is total bullcrap for one thing, because, you know, this whole idea of, the butterfly flapping its wings causing snowstorms in other parts of the world, it's ridiculous. But what it does, Vicky, is it provides an excuse to control all private property, all land.
Well, that's exactly what he said. They basically turned our entire country into a park that they manage.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned the Everglades, but he said outside of the park boundaries. The area that he was talking about in California, that's the area that Rosa Corey and Michael Shaw are fighting the Plan Bay Area, One Bay Area Plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where this group, ABAG, is trying to take over land management for the entire Bay region. What they've done is to basically turn our country into regions that they... And so in how that relates to the Bundy Ranch, they, the BLM... believes that they have a right to manage his ranch and the land of all the other ranchers. And I forgot what I was going to say. It's really so important what he said there.
Yeah. Well,
the sheriffs. That's why the BLM does not recognize the authority of the sheriffs, because they think that their federal regional eco-management authority supersedes the sheriff's authority, because the sheriff's authority is on the land, but this eco-management system is... it's really at a global level. It is at an international level.
Yeah, well, we're seeing really a concept, the whole two competing things, I find, even with the migration-immigration thing, which if we have time, maybe we'll get into some a little bit too, because that's really come on the stage in a big way with this presidential campaign. But we're seeing really a competing thing with our traditional constitution and our national laws competing with international treaties and agreements. And so on the one hand, people call the migrants coming here as being illegals, but on the other hand, the globalists are looking at this as refugees or migrants under what they call human rights treaties. So they're not illegals at all. They have a special status, which is why they're getting special privileges above and beyond what the natives, you know, get.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this whole technocratic system, Tim Worth was the first director of a new office called the Office of Global Affairs. And when he was talking to State Department employees, or maybe it was in the President's Council on Sustainable Development, he was talking about population and consumption. We have a smaller population than a lot of countries, but we have a higher level of consumption.
Right.
And so what their global agenda was is to reduce one of those.
Yeah.
You know, or both of them, you know.
Well, and there's a whole chapter in Agenda 21 which deals with changing consumption patterns.
Yes. And bringing these people in from the Middle East will change our consumption patterns because they're getting the jobs. We're not.
Yeah.
The American people are being basically economically displaced by foreign labor. And that's with illegal aliens walking across the border. It's with H-1Bs. It's with the refugee program. And the people coming in that they're calling refugees, they are not refugees. They are economic migrants.
Yeah. All right. Let's take the bottom of the hour break. We'll be back in a moment. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. And this is Govern America. Please stay put. United forevermore. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website, our website. And you can go to Vicki's website, which is The Technocratic Tyranny. That's The Technocratic Tyranny. That's her website, .com. TheTechnocraticTyranny.com. And remember, make sure you put the in there, otherwise you'll probably get to something else. Anyway, by the way, my email address is radio@governamerica.com. That's radio@governamerica.com. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, Vicki, how do they do that?
My email address is on my old website. I think it's on my new website, too, on the About tab or menu item. But it's on my old website on the left-hand side. If you look down, you'll see it. It's eyeswideoopen@channelingreality.com.
Okay.
I always direct people to where it is because it's so long, but I've had it for so many years. I can't change it. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I understand. Well, I try to do is I made an alias because I used to use my name and the email address, and I realized it wasn't radio friendly because I had to spell it every time. So anyway, yeah, we do the best we can regarding that. Any thoughts on the current presidential campaign, Vicki?
Well, I'm supporting Trump because he said that he will fix those trade agreements. And fixing those trade agreements would break this whole international system that they have that has just destroyed our economy.
Yeah.
I think they're all really afraid of him because he knows what they've done, you know, with basically signing away our sovereignty through these sequential international agreements. I don't know if he knows the full extent of it, but if he starts with international trade, that will take us a long way to restoring our country.
Well, I know a lot of people in the Patriot effort are supporting Trump, and for that reason, he's making a lot of the right noises. The problem I have, of course, is that as soon as he gets in there, this is the thing. I notice, I think it was his rally in Detroit, that immediately he starts going back on his word. I'll play a little audio from this here.
Hi.
Hello.
How you doing?
Nice to be with you, Megan.
Great to have you here.
Okay, this is him being drilled by Megyn Kelly at the last, I think, it's hard to say the last because they're having these things all the time anymore. But this is something I wanted to cover regarding him backtracking already on his word.
Well, you're looking
as are you. Back in
January, you gave an off-the-record interview to the New York Times. It was apparently audio-taped. Now, a recent report in BuzzFeed, citing sources at the Times, reports that in that interview, you expressed flexibility when it comes to your immigration policy, specifically with respect to your promise to deport the 11 million people who are now living here illegally. You have suggested that you may have expressed some flexibility when it comes to the size of the wall that you want to build, but did you tell them specifically that you are flexible when it comes to your deportation plans?
I don't know exactly what, when you talk about off the record. First of all, BuzzFeed, they were the ones that said under no circumstances will I run for president, and were they wrong? But a lot of people said that. Then I did have a meeting with the editorial board of the New York Times, a very nice meeting. Many of those things were off the record, I think at their suggestion and my suggestion, and I think being off the record is a very important thing. I think it's a very, very powerful thing. And I will say this, these three gentlemen have gone off the record many times with reporters, and I think they want to honor it, and I would always honor that. I will say, though, in terms of immigration and almost anything else, there always has to be some, you know, tug and pull and deal. And, you know, when I watched Ted stand on the Senate floor, I had great respect for what he did. He stood there for a day and a half or something. In the meantime, what came of it? Nothing. You have to be able to have some flexibility, some negotiation. Now, sometimes you ask for more than you want and you negotiate down to the point. I may have discussed something like that with the New York Times, but I would never release off-the-record conversations. I don't think it's fair, frankly, to do that to anybody.
How flexible are you on this issue?
Not very flexible. No, not.
I notice he's getting booed from the audience.
I give the example. I'm going to build a wall. I'm the one that wants the wall. I'm the one that can build the wall. It's going to get built. And by the way, Mexico is going to pay for the wall. I can tell you that. Mexico is going to pay for the wall. But, and I used an example, and this isn't necessarily what was said, but whatever was said, the wall's 50 feet high. Is it going to be 45 feet or 40 feet? That could very well be. That could very well, he wants it to be higher. That could very well be. But there's always give and take, there's always negotiation, and the best negotiator that knows what he's doing will make a great deal. But we need give and take in government. If you don't have give and take, you're never going to agree on anything.
Okay, so, you know, he's saying a lot of things, and you know, Mexico's going to pay for the wall. How is he going to get this done? I mean, here's what former Mexican leader Vicente Fox said.
I declare, I'm not going to pay for that f***ing wall.
So, well, you know, I don't know why he was talking. I think he was just, you know, feeding a little bit of raw meat to the audience. Because we really don't need a wall. What all we need to do is to prosecute
the offenders,
employers that hire them.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you can't tell the difference between a Mexican and an American is stupid.
Yeah.
Big clue, they don't speak English.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of things here. This is my thing. I would love to be able to say, you know, here's our hero and here's the man. I think, you know, he's just spouting this stuff the very much the same way Obama spouted a lot of promises when he came in that he's going to end the wars and all this stuff. You know, my problem is I'd love to be able to believe it, but here's another thing. Okay, last week, and I don't know if you happened to catch last week's show or not, we talked about the notion that there's this STEM shortage, the shortage of, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math jobs in this country. I think it's complete hooey, and there are people who have studied this situation, who have come to similar conclusions, that there is no shortage, there is no STEM worker shortage in this country, but this is an excuse that the pro-migration or immigrant, whatever you want to call them, people, the people who are all in favor of letting all these foreigners come here, they're pushing this idea that we need these minds. We got a brain drain in America, okay?
Yeah.
And
none of that is true.
No, because for one thing, I find it incredibly insulting to the American people that we're too stupid to run our own stuff. Now, there may be little pockets of areas where we don't have enough people in there, but maybe that's because we're not paying enough. Maybe that's because I mean, there are other incentives to get people to go into those areas. And if, in fact, those incentives are offered, and I'm talking monetary benefit, whatever, I mean, you're going to have, you know, if it makes sense to a person going to college, considering a career, to go into that field, they're going to do it if you make it profitable enough. But here you have Trump in a complete flip-flop regarding this whole STEM idea.
Mr. Trump, your campaign website to this day argues that more visas for highly skilled workers would, quote, decimate American workers. However, at the CNBC debate, you spoke enthusiastically in favor of these visas. So which is it?
I'm changing. We need highly skilled people in this country, and if we can't do it, we'll get them in. But, and we do need, in Silicon Valley, we absolutely have to have. So we do need highly skilled. And one of the biggest problems we have is people go to the best colleges. They'll go to Harvard, they'll go to Stanford, they'll go to Wharton. As soon as they're finished, they get shoved out. They want to stay in this country. They want to stay here desperately. They're not able to stay here. For that purpose, we absolutely have to be able to keep the brain power in this country.
So you are abandoning the position on your website.
I'm changing it, and I'm softening the position because we have to have talented people in this country.
And you're not releasing the discussion with the New York Times behind closed doors.
You just did it. You played the magic soundbite for me. If that's what he's going to do, is to set up that guest worker program so that we can continue to have H-1B workers come into this program, that's it. I don't support Trump.
I'm sorry. You know, yeah, I really am sorry.
That's the killer issue for me, because I know that it's not true. When I was working on the foreign worker issue, one of the guys that was in our group, his daughter had just graduated from a university with honors in engineering, and she could not get a job. I mean, she had educational credentials from the school that she just graduated in precisely what they say there are shortages in, and she could not find a job.
Yeah. Well, and last week we played audio from, I wish I could remember the organization's name, but these people seem to be very much on top of this whole, issue with regard to the migration. I think it's the Center on Immigration Studies or something like that, a gentleman speaking in regard to this whole STEM idea. And anybody that wants to hear that can go back and listen to last week's show, because I think this is very critical. It's a very critical argument to debunk that we somehow need foreigners here to fill these roles. You know, we haven't always done that.
Oh. No, we never did it. That started in the 1990s, and it's the reason it started. They needed to bring over people from foreign countries to learn the IT business because of the global control grid that they're installing everywhere. You know, so they needed trained IT people in countries that had never had technology before. Well, what they did is they destroyed our own knowledge base in the IT industry. You know, you just don't walk into the business and, you know, suddenly, magically, you're able to design systems. It's a career that takes time to learn, you know, and so they destroyed the career path for our young people.
Yeah. Well, and regarding this whole Trump thing, you know, one thing that Megyn Kelly mentioned, I didn't play the last 9 seconds of that clip, but she mentioned his book, The Art of the Deal. I went ahead and bought the book last night on Amazon Kindle so I could find this spot that she was referencing. This is what he said in a chapter called Get the Word Out. He says, "One thing I've learned about the press is that they're always hungry for a good story, and the more sensational, the better. It's in the nature of the job, and I understand that. The point is that if you're a little different or a little outrageous, or if you do things that are bold and controversial, oh, I don't know, like say that Mexico is going to build that wall, the press is going to write about you. I've always done done things a little differently. I don't mind controversy, and my ideals tend to be somewhat ambitious. Also, I've achieved a lot when I was very young, and I chose to live a certain style. The result is that the press has always wanted to write about me. I'm not saying that they necessarily like me. Sometimes they write positively, and sometimes they write negatively. But from a pure business point of view, the benefits of being written about have far outweighed the drawbacks. It's really quite simple. If I take a full-page ad in the New York Times and publicize a project, it might cost $40,000, and in any case, people tend to be skeptical about advertising. But if the New York Times writes even a moderately positive one-column story about one of my deals, it doesn't cost me anything, and it's worth a lot more than $40,000. The funny thing is that even a critical story, which may be hurtful personally, can be very valuable for your business. Television City is a perfect example. When I bought land in 1985, many people, even those on the West Side, didn't realize that those 100 acres existed. Then I announced I was going to build the world's tallest building on the site. Instantly, it became a media event. The New York Times put it on the front page. Dan Rather announced it on the evening news. And George Will wrote a column about it in Newsweek. Every architecture critic had an opinion, and so did a lot of editorial writers. Not all of them liked the idea of the world's tallest building, but the point is, we've got a lot of attention, and that alone creates value. Now, skipping down here, and this is really the punchline here. He says, the final key to the way I promote is bravado. I play to people's fantasies. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those who do. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. People want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. I call it truthful hyperbole. It's an innocent form of exaggeration and a very effective form of promotion. I just found that kind of interesting, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to get into it. I guess the reason I pick on Trump is because he's the one that has the most populist appeal to the patriot movement. And I understand the problem is everybody's looking for heroes. And yeah, granted, we need them, but you know, they're false heroes, unfortunately.
Yeah, we don't need heroes that want to bring in foreign labor that replaces American labor, American workers. They want that guest worker program because that is control of the workforce. And that's always been part of the technocratic system, is management of the labor force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, they really need to have foreign... You can't manage... If you don't... you can't manage a guest worker program and balance labor needs unless you manage the domestic side.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to have both sides to be able to manage it, right?
Yeah, we got another caller on the line. Let me go ahead and take the caller. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Who do we have?
This is Mark.
Hey,
you know,
Mark.
There was a time when, we used to know the difference between right and wrong. And it was usually involved, you know, damage to another individual. But if you remember the Iraq War, they were having a hard time convincing, you know, us common folk that that'd be a good thing to do. But then what happened? I don't remember if it was Rumsfeld or if it was Cheney said, it's not going to cost you nothing. We're going to have Iraq pay for it with their oil. Well, gun-ho, here we go.
There you go.
Well, that's the same thing that Trump's doing with the wall. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. And I'm going to say, yeah, probably it's an okay idea. But the thing is, if it doesn't cost us nothing, well, that's okay.
Yep.
If we want a wall, we'll pay for it ourselves.
Well, I'm yet to hear him explain exactly what his strategy is for getting them to pay for the wall. I mean, is he going to send the military down there and point all the guns at them and say, all right, you either do this or we're going to bomb you into the Stone Age? I don't.
Well, there's a lot of conjecture out there on that. You know, Wells Fargo sending all the money to Mexico, put a, you know, a tariff based on an export tax on the money. There's lots of ways you could do it without, you know, physically going down there with bullets and guns and stuff. You could do it lots of ways, but still, it still comes down to if a buck can be made off of an activity or a program, it's legitimate.
You're right.
If a buck
can
be made, it's legitimate. There's no right or wrong for an individual anymore. It's all about making that dollar.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, listen.
Here, but
that's fine.
You're absolutely right, and that I believe is the result of the economic destruction, that they've destroyed our economy and made people desperate for that dollar. And at whatever scale of living that you live at, it seems like that people are desperate across the board, you know, to keep up with their neighbors or I mean, hell, it's like they're willing to sell their soul for money.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost as if we would go to war just because somebody else is, what, manipulating their currency.
Yeah.
Well, excuse me.
That never happens, by the way.
It's their currency.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we are the world's greatest at it.
Well, and it's not even just manipulating.
Since 1913.
Well, there you go. Well, you know, and even to some degree before that, you know, here's the thing. It's not even just manipulating their currency. It's the fact that they're not using our currency.
Well, we can't have that.
No.
Well, we can't talk about that either, because then people might understand how this whole...
You know, what's going to take place is all these countries, they're going to finally, and I think it's already coming to fruition, they're going to decide that, you know, we got oil. Are we got cars or computers or something? Well, United States, we don't want to take that monopoly money for it anymore. What else do you have to trade? And I bet you this TPP, I could be wrong because I haven't read the 6,000 plus pages or whatever it is. I wouldn't be surprised if China cars are fixing to come to Walmart. I bet you somewhere down in there is something about China cars coming to America. And boy, wait till that hits the fan.
Yeah.
Wait till that shows up. God bless you guys.
Hey, God bless you.
Listen on the telephone.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
Yep. Blessings to you, Mark. Thanks for calling in. Yeah. I don't know about the China cars at Walmart, but I shudder to think about the self-driving China cars.
Yeah, no, I don't. I do not want a self-driving car. But you remember that when GM got their bailout money, they took their bailout money and built factories over in China. Don't you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Very vividly, as a matter of fact.
So there you go. Yeah, they're probably ready to start importing.
Yep. Oh, man. It's insane. It's really insane. You know, and speaking of insane, we have our illustrious Secretary of State. Earlier we were talking about the State Department. John Kerry was holding a dinner, Vicky, for the Canadian Prime Minister. You know, the socialist Justin Trudeau?
Oh, yeah. He's a Muslim, by the way. He said the prayer in a mosque.
Oh, charming.
That basically is the baptism or whatever, however they determine it. But, yeah. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, that's okay. Anyway, he's talking about Canada and the U.S. relations.
The fact is that no country so directly impacts American life as does Canada. A lot of people don't focus on that every day.
You know, everybody should focus on that. You know, every day I get up in the morning, Vicky, and I say, Canada really affects my life.
Some degree, as the President and the Prime Minister acknowledged earlier, taken for granted. But on a daily basis, more than $1.8 billion of goods and services is exchanged between our two nations on a daily basis. For the majority of U.S. states, including my home Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Canada is the number one export market. Along the U.S.-Canadian border, the longest international border in the world, There are more than 120 crossings, and on any given day, nearly 400,000 people pass through them on their way to work, school, personal visits, or vacation. Now, let me be clear. The reason that our friendship has endured is not a matter of geography. It's the extraordinary depth of affection and respect that exists between our peoples. It is our nation's commitment to shared interests and shared values and to promoting and defending those interests and those values around the world, and we couldn't have a better partner in doing that. That's why, as NATO allies, our military men and women have served side by side in Kosovo, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Together, they curb threats to stability.
Actually, they create threats to stability.
Increase citizens' security and provide essential humanitarian aid to local communities. It's why our nations have joined our European partners in demonstrating solidarity for a democratic Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression. It's why we're collaborating closely on counterterrorism and the fight against Daesh. Now, I want to emphasize how much we appreciate Prime Minister Trudeau's decisions and the choices he has made regarding that effort, his generosity also, and his courage.
In
welcoming 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada.
Yeah, all right. He's a traitor. He's backstabbing his people. Woohoo!
Yeah, so they'll come in there, and then they'll just be able to come right across the border.
Yeah. Isn't it wonderful that he's such a patriot that he's doing all of this?
Go on to talk
about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
It is also why our nations recently joined together to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will deepen trade and investment, raise labor and environmental standards, and link together countries that represent nearly 40% of global GDP.
40%, and of course, you know, the key word there is link together countries.
Yeah, everything is a link. Linking.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, there's more to that, but I think we're just about out of time. This is kind of a fun show. I appreciate it.
It was
certainly a lot happening.
Yeah, and I'm going to continue to study the President's Council on Sustainable Development. I'm not finished yet. I'll probably have three or four more things that I'm going to write on different aspects of it.
All right. And whenever you want, you can come back and talk about it out here on the show.
I will do that. Thank you for having me, Darren. I really enjoyed it.
It's always a blessing, Vicki. Thank you for being with us. And folks, I wanted to say thank you to all of you folks out there. Just in the way of housekeeping, we settled our lawsuit for the copyright thing. It ended up costing us $400. We had a number of people step forward without us even asking for it. You folks stepped forward and donated to the point where it more than made up for the entire amount that we ended up having to pay out for that. So I deeply appreciate all of you folks and the people that stepped forward and put forth comments and stuff that are encouraging, and you do so on a regular basis. Thank you. It means more than you ever know. Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. God bless each and every one of you. And we'll talk to you again real soon. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.